What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark Latham.
Good morning, Mark Latham. How are you?
Good, thanks. In a dancing mood, Brent. You've got us all livened up.
I was going to ask the question. I have to ask the question. Have you ever done the political dance move?
No, well, they have those big presidential rallies in the United States, don't they? So it's more akin to their system. The only one I can remember here was Peter Costello did the Macarena once on a TV show. That's probably right. The most infamous dancing exercise we've seen here.
The midday show with Kerry-Anne Kenealy.
That's it, back in the day. One.
Did you see about overnight Donald Trump, apparently at one of his dues, the microphone failed. So he had nothing to do for 20 minutes while they fixed the microphone, so he just walked around the stage.
Well, I suppose you've got to do something. Yeah. Go out and shake their hands and thank the supporters for being there. Bit of a technical failure, but I'm sure he'll survive that. There's worse things happening in this campaign.
I thought they could have put some YMCA on and he could have had a dance to.
That's it, yeah. Everyone loves
people.
That dance move of his, so I don't know what Kamala Harris's problem is. She was at a rally I saw overnight where someone yelled out, Jesus is Lord, and she told them they were at the wrong rally.
Oh, really?
So given the size of the Christian vote in the United States, I think that's a bit of a clanger.
Bit of a mistake. Let's talk about the King and Queen. They arrived here around about 8:30 in the rain on Saturday night. They took it easy yesterday. I couldn't believe they're leaving on Wednesday. Gee, it's a short visit.
Short and light workload. The King is coming here to the New South Wales Parliament today, where I am at the moment, for a reception and lunch celebrating the bicentenary of the New South Wales Legislative Council. So we won't see the Queen, apparently, but it's his first official engagement on this trip. He never made it to the Everest yesterday, much to the disappointment of Racing New South Wales, but I don't think he was ever going to do that. But it's good that he's going to be marking the 200 years of partial or full democracy in Australia through the New South Wales upper house.
No doubt you are going to be in attendance at that lunch?
Yeah, that's why I'm here. I'm speaking from the New South Wales Parliament House office of mine, and all the members of Parliament, upper and lower house, have been invited and their partners, so I'm expecting the King will make a speech. He was actually here as the Prince of Wales for the sesquicentenary of the upper house, the 150 years, obviously 50 years ago. So, yeah, a bit of continuity in his appearances at these celebrations.
Look, it's the elephant in the room in the last week, and that is the purchase of Anthony Albanese spending $4.3 million on a cliffside beach home in the Central Coast. I see that the Nationals leader, David Littleproud, he weighed in earlier this week on the debate over the recent purchase of the home on the New South Wales Central Coast. While the Coalition's reactions have been mixed, David Littleproud took a more balanced approach, I thought. He defended Anthony Albanese's right to invest in property. I mean, if he's made some wise decisions in reference to buying and selling property in recent years and he hasn't squandered the money, he has saved the money, he's in a position now financially to be able to buy a nice home on the Central Coast for he and his bride-to-be.
Well, of course, people in any walk of life can make their property investments, but in a housing affordability crisis, a lot of people will be saying, is it the right time for the Prime Minister to have a $4.3 million purchase on a beachside property? It just looks out of whack on a couple of fronts. I suppose for me what jars most is Albanese makes so much of his log cabin background story that he lived in a council flat in Camperdown with his mother who was on a disability pension. He's made a lot of that consistently in his time in the Labor leadership. Well, it's got people asking, where'd all the money come from?
Yeah,
to then buy such a property on the Central Coast. You can't have it both ways. You can't tell people that you're poor, but then be purchasing $4.3 million property investment. So where did all the money come from for him to achieve that? And maybe he needs to run a seminar to help people with housing affordability. You can do it the Albo way and upgrade consistently in Sydney. Maybe that's the answer.
Well, unfortunately, he suffers from, and successful people in this country do suffer from, Mark, and that is the tall poppy syndrome. It is alive and well.
Yeah, I suppose so, but there's also a question, did he really have that log cabin poverty story in the first place? So it was put to me once that he had an uncle who passed away, ran a printing business at Botany and got a very good inheritance, and that's the basis of the financial capacity he's relied on since with these property investments. Well, if he didn't have that poverty-ridden story in the first place, don't tell it. And if you have been able to upgrade so successfully to buy a $4.3 million property on the Central Coast, tell us how you did it over time, and maybe some young people can take inspiration from that and overcome this dreadful housing affordability crisis.
I do agree with you. I do think it's time he put the... I grew up in a council... I grew up in a tough environment. I think it's time he put that in the knapsack.
Yeah, well, it doesn't square with the recent announcement, does it, of that property purchase. So, yeah, you can't have it both ways, and probably people have grown sick and tired of hearing about that story from Camperdown.
Senior government ministers are ruling out changes to negative gearing. I suppose we're talking about negative gearing, Albo, buying and selling homes. So senior government ministers are ruling out changes to negative gearing amid reports of a push within Labor to reform the tax benefit. Labor MPs have been, as we know, pushing for changes to negative gearing after Albo's purchase of the 4.3 property sparked backlash. But the Deputy Prime Minister, Richard Marles, on Thursday of this week dismissed suggestions that anything had changed, saying no doors have been opened on the divisive issue, Mark.
Well, the interesting thing politically was that the backlash came from unnamed Labor backbenchers, shocked, horrified that the Prime Minister had made this purchase and it had got into the media. And they were also telling the media on background, anonymously, that it's time to change the negative gearing rules in Australia. But it's probably the worst time. If you get rid of negative gearing, obviously you're going to take some investment out of the property rental market. Rents will go up. We saw that experience in the 80s when the Hawke government did it. And it would be repeated now at the worst possible time. So Labor backbenchers were saying this, but I think they've got the policy all wrong. But interestingly, they are thinking that the Prime Minister's property investment is at the wrong time. He should have done it after the election, and it's going to hurt them in their marginal seats.
By-election results over the weekend. Last night, the Libs were bracing for a loss of the prize Northern Beaches seat of Pittwater. I think, have they conceded? What's the latest on that, Mark? Have they now conceded defeat? The Libs have conceded defeat. And the Teals have taken that out at Pittwater.
Well, they should concede defeat because the Teal candidate, Scrooby, has got 56% of the primary vote, and the Liberals have only got 42, so they're well behind, and it's inconceivable that late counting of postal votes and the like could save them. So Pittwater's gone, and I suppose it's not that surprising. If you're a Liberal voter there on the northern beaches of Sydney in the seat of Pittwater, you'd be saying to yourself, well, just 18 months ago, the Liberals got me to vote for someone who then resigned as an alleged pedophile, and I'm a Liberal voter for council elections, and they couldn't get their nominations in for those, and I was disenfranchised. So enough people, about 5-6% of Liberal voters, have decided to lodge a protest vote against their party and hand the seat to the Teals, which is not just obviously bad for the Liberals in Pittwater. It will now encourage the Teals at the next state election to run in other North Shore seats. They didn't win any of those North Shore electorates in March of last year at the general election, but they'll be encouraged and emboldened now to think, well, we'll have a crack because we've won Pittwater. So, yeah, a bit of a disaster there for the Liberal Party and opposition leader Mark Speakman.
Well, speaking of Mark Speakman, he told reporters last night that everyone had always known what a challenging proposition it was going to be in Pittwater, but in the seats of Epping and Hornsby, they weren't having the same sort of problems at all.
Well, Labor didn't run in any of these three by-elections, and in Epping, Monica Toodhope has got 56% of the primary vote, and James Wallace for the Liberal Party in Hornsby has got 50%, so they win on primaries, which are strong results, but not really reflective of the main contest because Labor didn't run. I think the main issue for Mark Speakman as opposition leader is, what does he stand for? Does anyone know who he is? If you voted in Pittwater, would you think, oh, there's a Speakman policy or profile that I really like? I don't think anyone did that at all. So the local factors in Pittwater wiped them out, and there was no reason for anyone to think that the opposition leader had anything to offer. So I think he's got to get, you know, cracking in terms of fighting harder on issues, raising his profile and putting some policies out there to help small business, for example. Other traditional Liberal Party constituencies who so far have heard nothing from this guy.
In your opinion, if he was to step aside, who would be a couple of people that might replace Mark Speakman as the leader of the Liberals in New South Wales?
I think the main contenders would be Alastair Henskins, the Shadow Attorney General, or Kelly Sloan, newly elected, who's the Shadow Health Minister. They seem to be the two that people talk about. They haven't got a galaxy of riches there. So I think it would be a race in two, but they'll probably stick with Speakman because of the difficulty in making a replacement this far from the election. I mean, the general election's not until 2027, fixed date in March of that year for New South Wales, so they'd be foolish to make any change now. But I think out of Pittwater, if you're a Liberal Party backbencher in their party room, it would be certainly appropriate to stand up and say, listen, Mr. Speakman, you've got to lift your profile, you've got to campaign harder on the government's errors, and you've got to put some policies out there that people can identify with.
I'm reminded of the saying, if you haven't been doing it and you're not doing it now, you're not going to do it in the future.
Yeah, well, he's a weak sort of character, Speakman. He's sort of, his own beliefs are very much on the green side of politics, crazy about the environment and climate change and those issues. So, yeah, he's got some real problems and challenges, and the Pittwater result just shows so far no Liberal voter can support him just in his own right.
The Equality Bill passed through New South Wales Parliament's upper house on Thursday night, and it will allow transgender people to change their birth certificates without having to undergo surgery. The bill makes threatening as well to out an LGBTIQA plus person an offence, Mark.
Well, I think the birth certificate change is particularly weird, isn't it? I mean, on the day of your birth, there's a record there set in stone, really, that you were born male, female. I suppose hermaphrodite is a third option if it can be identified at the point of birth, at the birth certificate lists your parents, where you were born, obviously the date. And those things are just an historical record as a matter of fact. But to have now at law that 20 or 30 years later you can change that history, and biological science, you know, we're constantly told follow the science on climate change, but it's out the window in terms of this law that's been passed now to say that if you're born male, you can years later say it was actually female. And it's a rewriting of the history. So I think it'd be more appropriate if trans people want to self-identify, and that was the decision of the Parliament, to have a separate document appended to your birth certificate that doesn't rewrite history, that doesn't wipe biological science, and still remains as a accurate reflection of what actually happened on your birthday. That's really the purpose of a birth certificate.
It is, yeah. The Albanese government plans to tackle excessive surcharges on debit credit card transactions, with the Housing Minister, Claire O'Neill, stating these charges are downright unfair and excessive. Australians currently pay around $4 billion a year in such fees, and the government aims to reduce these costs for retailers and consumers. Mark, do you think that it should have been credit cards that were included in this change as well, this purported change as well, not just debit cards? And why is it taking so long? I mean, we're talking 2026. Why can't it be done now when people need assistance financially?
Well, why wasn't it done 20 years ago? Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was in the federal parliament, you know, some time ago, sitting on a committee that asked questions of the Reserve Bank, and this was a big issue. Why are these credit card and debit card charges allowed to persist when they are 10, 20, 50 times greater than the actual cost to the companies involved, the financial institutions? And the Reserve Bank back then was saying, yeah, well, we should get rid of these unrepresentative inflated fees, and it's never really happened. So, you know, it's good to have this announcement, but it should have happened yesterday rather than a couple of years from now, and it should also apply to the credit card fees that are way over the top in terms of the cost to the institutions.
The ridiculous thing also with credit cards is there's not a large percentage of people in Australia that pay off their total credit card bill each and every month. And if you don't do that, if you only pay the minimum amount, the interest charges that the banks throw at you, 20% up each and every month on money that you owe. It's just ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, that's another inflated charge. I mean, the fees we're talking about in the age of information technology are next to nothing in cost to the institutions, but they charge way in excess of that, and 20% interest is obviously way over toad odds. So that should come down as well to reflect the current rate, competitive rate of interest, maybe a small loading because you haven't paid, but not 20%. It's excessive as well. So the banks continue to get a free run from government, and government could act. I'm sure there'd be political will, but something's gone wrong in the system.
Australians are questioning why the Albanese government created an ambassador for First Nations peoples to embed First Nations perspectives into Australia's foreign policy. Why do Indigenous Australians need separate representation in foreign affairs? And why don't other minority groups, like, for example, Mark, maybe the Greeks, Vietnamese Australians, have similar roles? I see that the Liberal Senator, Alex Anti, has criticised the role, calling it divisive and unnecessary, saying we are all Australians. He questions why other minority groups don't have similar representation. Why is this role necessary, and do you think it really truly benefits Australia's interests, Mark? It seems to be just, and what they pay this bloke, I mean, $350,000+ a year, it's a lot of money.
And a lot of travel. Apparently he gets around a fair bit. I don't know what he does in talking to other governments. It can only be a negative reflection on Australia, which is not good foreign policy in itself. And the position is bizarre in that, what was the Indigenous foreign policy pre-1788? Well, obviously there was none. There was no written record of it, obviously, and there was no need for a foreign policy because they didn't know foreigners existed. So there can never be an Aboriginal foreign policy that reflects Aboriginal history and culture. The only thing this person can do is travel overseas at taxpayers' expense and criticise Australia for colonisation and allegations of genocide and all this sort of thing that we hear about. So why are we paying someone who can only play a negative role on the world stage at taxpayers' expense? Abolish the position, pass the savings into the budget, and I'm sure there's a lot of people thinking, geez, I'm struggling to pay my household bills. Here's a guy being funded to give Australia a bagging to other countries on an issue that really doesn't exist, because there can never really be a thing called Indigenous foreign policy.
Just before I let you go, the news poll at the top of the week, 51-49, the Coalition leads Labor. It's just one poll. I know there are other polls that show it's 50-50, but what it's telling me is now that all the results of all of the polls that are taken by the different news outlets, it's just very, very, very close. Neck and neck will be the end result of the election in May, unless there are major changes by either party.
Well, the Coalition's in front for the first time in that poll since the last election. And also last night, or yesterday, there was an election in the ACT where there was a swing against Labor. Now, my understanding down there is that there was no reason there'd be a swing against Labor other than the Albanese factor. And those by-elections we had here, the Liberals were saying there was so much hostility in the door-knocking to Albanese. So he's really gone downhill since the Voice referendum. He's lost his confidence in his judgment of the opinions of the Australian people. All the issues like the Coca-Cabana household purchase and all that, every event seems to be running against him. So it's no surprise that Peter Dutton's in front now. And maybe that lead will strengthen in the coming period, Brent. So, you know, Albanese may well be leading a first-term government. Doesn't normally happen in Australia. You've got to go back to the Great Depression the last time it did happen. But he's getting everything wrong politically. Dutton's probably doing everything right. And the next election really could be an upset victory for the Coalition.
A little over 2 weeks before November 5 and the US election, your thoughts before I let you go? It's down to the line, isn't it? So many commentators are saying we probably won't see a result on November 5.
Well, some of the polling shows that Trump has edged ahead. I don't think Harris, with that disastrous interview with Brett Baer, or telling Christians that they're not welcome at her rallies, is going all that well. I know Trump is an imperfect candidate and not everyone's cup of tea, but Kamala Harris is doing very few interviews and appearances, and those that she does are sending her backwards. So I'm sort of at this stage backing Trump. I think Trump will get across the line. It won't be a landslide. It won't be a big win. It won't be without controversy, of course, given the nature of the guy. But at this stage, you'd have to think he's the favourite.
Do you know what's on the menu for lunch?
Well, three courses, that's all we're told. I can report that there's plenty of activity at the front of the Parliament House building on Macquarie Street. The red carpet has been laid out in both the stairways up to the chambers and the luncheon area. Plenty of police around, a few monarchists on the other side of the road trying to get a glimpse of the King as he comes out of his car there on Macquarie Street. So it should be a pretty good lunch. The head chef here goes all right. So a good lunch and a good event celebrating our bicentenary and plenty of activity around on Macquarie Street. Most more, probably the police outnumbering anyone else at the moment.
Have you met the King?
No. I was once at a reception with his mother back in Canberra in the federal parliament, but I saw the King 2 years ago at Royal Ascot,
right,
passing by in his carriage, so that's as close as I've got, so today's a bit better.
All right, mate, enjoy your lunch. I'm sure you will. The food will no doubt be absolutely delicious. So enjoy your lunch, and we'll look forward to talking to you next Sunday.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Well, the King himself, I think, has some dietary quirks. He has a raw egg with every meal or something. So I don't know.
Well, he just has a the Queen. Mark, I'm up on these dietary things. Yes, I can tell you now that the King, now, he didn't used to have lunch. He would have breakfast. He'd miss lunch and he'd have dinner. Uh-huh. But what he would do for lunch, he'd go for a walk. Well, that's now changed, and the Queen is now making sure that he has half an avocado every day for lunch instead of the walk.
Okay, well, maybe avocado's on the menu, but he's also battling this cancer problem,
yeah.
So that's why the program is light, and I'm sure the lunch will be very healthy.
All right, mate. We'll catch up with you next Sunday.
Thanks,
you, Mark.
Cheers.
See you, mate. Bye-bye. That's Mark Latham.